In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Major Burke pinned the woman to the wall with a volley of tomahawks. Then he shot at her with a rifle. Bob Carlyle looked on, but oddly did not seek to intervene on behalf of the abused lady. The woman too seemed remarkably unperturbed. The bullet from the rifle missed the top of her head by a whisker, exploding a clay pipe that had just been placed there and showering her face with the remains. Yet she didn't flinch. Carlyle stepped forward and shouted,
"Your gratitude, please, for Major Burke, the champion sharpshooter, and Mrs. Burke, his willing accomplice."
The crowd roared of approval at this display of skill and nerve, but the applause quickly morphed into an apprehensive buzz as a group of Zulu warriors stepped out of the shadows and commenced a dramatic dance to the beat of a dangerous drum. The dancers were clad in animal skins and the audience gasped to see their bare feet skipping nimbly over a carpet of broken glass. Then Bob Carlyle once more ascended the stage, dressed in the well-worn showman's garb of a Chesterfield coat and a top hat. He pushed a wheelbarrow with him and reminded the audience that it was he, the original and greatest wheelbarrow pedestrian, famed from the bottom of Cornwall to the top of Scotland for his fortitude and endurance. He regaled the crowd with anecdotes of his own endeavours and then went on to paint a picture of life on the American frontier. The crowd were rapt at his tales of Wild West adventure. And then the drumbeat started once more. Major Burke's Wild West show lived up to its billing for the working men of Glasgow that afternoon in July 1894, and Bob Carlyle was in his element, a star attraction, feeding off the energy of the crowd and playing up his finest hour, the Great Wheelbarrow Walk of 1879, which was now a fading memory, but a memory that he was desperate to keep alive. He knew that little slice of celebrity was what he needed to keep the coppers coming in as he continued to dedicate himself to a career of walking and showmanship in the face of an onslaught of competition and a world that he saw changing rapidly around him. From History Extra, this is The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea, the amazing life of Bob Carlyle, Victorian sailor, showman, and sportsman extraordinaire. I'm David Musgrove, and I'd like to introduce you to Bob Carlyle. This is episode 6, Battling against Bovril. So this is the final episode of my journey with Bob Carlyle. He sailed the seas, run away to the circus, walked incredible distances with and without wheelbarrows, and battled with alcohol abuse. By now, we're into the 1890s. Carlyle was well into middle age. But with no financial reserves to fall back on, he was showing no signs of slowing down in promoting himself as a showman and propelling himself as a pedestrian. Those were his best hopes for making money, so he mixed work in the circuses with distance walking challenges. Several times he hiked 50 or 60 miles a day in exhibition events. But to be honest, interest was drying up, and he was receiving slim rewards. By this point, it really feels like the hype and frenzy of the wheelbarrow craze has sapped the enthusiasm for pedestrians pushing things amongst press and public alike, as this rather doleful entry in the Dundee Advertiser for Thursday, 27 December 1894 reveals.
It was in Dundee, in the person of one Gordon, that the wheelbarrow craze began. It was here yesterday in one Carlyle that brief revival ended. The barrow pushing business has long been played out. As it is, the venture has collapsed from sheer lack of support. For even wheelbarrow men cannot live on newspaper paragraphs and the admiration of small boys.
Admiration and newspaper articles indeed do not put food on the table, but Carlyle persisted with self-promotion and publicity despite the dwindling returns. In many ways, he feels to me to fit the same sort of mould as a modern-day social media influencer, constantly trying to grab a bit of attention. I wondered if Bob Nicholson, historian of Victorian media, agreed with my estimation of the man.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think we would be getting daily updates from him. I'm amazed that nobody has now tried to do this. Like modern influencers, he's very interested in himself, in his story. He wants to talk about himself to people. He wants to sort of say where he's come from, what his background is, what led him up to this moment. It's the personality attached to it. You have to be interested in the man, not just the thing he's trying to achieve. And Carlyle seems to have been really good at kind of building this sort of legend around him. And sometimes, you know, building sympathy around him, making people think, oh, we want to support this guy, you know, he's having a hard time, or he's attempting something magnificent. He's very good at building up his kind of self-mythologizing, I guess we'd say.
Perhaps the publication of Carlyle's second autobiography in 1896 was a reaction to the weakened wheelbarrow opportunities and his need, hard up as ever, to secure a new line of revenue. From 1896 through to 1901, though, the sources dry up for Bob Carlyle. There really isn't much about him in the newspapers, and he's not writing about himself. In 1901, an article notes that he was resident in Leith and employed in painting the docks. And in an interview that he gives in 1904, he notes that he's just had 5 years employment with Mr. Bostock's son in Glasgow as a general utility man. Not surprising, really, that he doesn't feature in the papers. But he wasn't ready to retire from the Showtime just yet. In 1901, Carlyle had a crack at an ambitious wheelbarrow mission of 120 miles in 48 hours from Leith to Berwick. It didn't work out, but in 1903, he was firmly back in the pedestrian saddle, trekking from Edinburgh to John O'Groats and back, and it looks like his primary motivation is to make some money.
When he arrived at a town, he usually went to the marketplace or cross, related the story of his tours and his adventures as a showman. Then, the collection was taken. Asked if he had made much money in his time, Carlyle said he had, but lost it in speculation in the show business and in undertaking things he knew nothing about.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
That was reported in the pages of the Linlithgowshire Gazetteer of 29 May 1903. From February to April 1904, in his late 50s by now, Carlyle was off again, back on the old route that he'd plied half a century earlier. At the start of the year, he embarked from John O'Groats with a view to returning once more to Land's End. And somewhat remarkably, people still remembered his previous effort. The Western Times of Monday, 18 April 1904, notes that in Devon, some of the people recognised Bob and remembered the schoolmaster, the late Mr. Holman, giving the children time off to see him pass with his wheelbarrow 25 years ago. As Bob Nicholson suggested to me, it seems that Carlyle's career trajectory goes from novelty to indifference to nostalgia, which, if you think about it, is often the fate of celebrities down the ages. Now, you might think that with the wheelbarrow craze of the 1880s having subsided, Carlyle wouldn't have had much competition. You'd be wrong. In late December 1898, and thanks to Linda Cammage of the Penwith Local History Group for acquainting me with this story, the fabulously named Beresford Great Heat pitched up in Penzance. He'd just walked in a triangle from Liverpool to London to John O'Groats and then down to Cornwall. But that was just a minor diversion in Great Heat's plans, as he'd already walked across Canada, where he'd been captured by Native Americans and fought bears, and on his way to stroll across Europe and Russia in a proposal to perambulate the globe without money or luggage. Great Heat came and went, but then there was Dr. Dayton. In 1903, he walked from London to Newcastle, and the following year, he went from London to John O'Groats. So far, so ordinary. That's nothing to write home about in the scheme of pedestrian endeavours that we've been talking about, but there was something new at play. Let's take an article from the Manchester Courier, Monday 21 March 1904.
The veteran Dr. Dayton, 61 years of age, hero of the 1903 London to Newcastle walk, arrived fresh and very fit at Dunblane on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. The walk from Land's End to John O'Groats should be completed this weekend. The doctor is going well and should finish his task in the time arranged. It may be noted that he is doing his training on Bovril.
Hang on, I'm going to have to stop myself. Bovril? Yep. Bovril. The Scotsman, John Lawson Johnston, had launched Bovril, the beef-based extract, as a response to the starvation of Napoleon III's army at the Siege of Paris in 1870 and 1871. He figured that he could resolve the problem if he could find a way to get preserved beef from the North American ranches over to Europe. Maybe you'll recall from episode 2 that Bob Carlyle had worked on cargo ships bringing live animals, including cattle, from America at around the same time. I mentioned then that was probably an unpleasant trip for both animals and sailors. John Lawson Johnston clocked that there was much economy and efficiency to be found in transporting processed food rather than the live animals. So he came up with the idea of heating cattle carcasses and reducing the resulting liquids into a blend with powdered dried meat. That was Bovril. The Cambridge University historian Leslie Steinitz has written about how Johnston managed to build up a huge market for Bovril in the latter part of the 19th and early 20th century, with some brilliant marketing and heavy advertising built around bulls and Britishness, laying heavily on the patriotism angle. He particularly latched onto an arms race that was going on in the early 20th century for products and supplements that would support a healthy, athletic life. Incidentally, here's something you might not know about the name of the popular paste. The bow bit comes from bovine, cows, but the vril bit comes from a popular occult or sci-fi novel of the day by the writer and politician Edward Bulwer Lytton, in which a subterranean master race drink an energy fluid called vril. The novel is a very odd read, by the way. Vril, the power of the coming race. Take a look. Anyway, Bovril had plumped for Dr. Dayton to be their poster boy. Well, older man, really. There was a great poster advertising his walk and the route he'll take. But he was a curious ambassadorial choice. He'd been an athletics instructor at Durham University for 15 years, and it was his students there who dubbed him the doctor, so the newspapers were always at pains to put his doctor credentials in air quotes. He was supposed to drink a cup of Bovril every day at the end of his exertions. Unfortunately,
the doctor was not particularly partial to the drink, so that ritual was only carried out when reporters were present. A report in the Dundee Evening Post of 28 March 1904 is instructive in this matter.
It was necessary for advertising purposes that a photograph of the doctor and his attendants should be taken at the finish, and he was accordingly persuaded to postpone the conclusion of his long journey until today. It must be said, however, that valuable time has frequently been devoted to dilating on the valuable properties of Bovril. Otherwise, the walk would have been accomplished easily within the specified time.
But while the newsmen were keen to report on the wandering doctor, where was Carlyle's coverage? We know that Carlyle walked the same route as Dayton in 1879, so it seems unlikely that the journalists weren't cognizant of his activities. More likely, the biggest factor is Bovril. Perhaps, just perhaps, the journalists had overlooked the previous exploits of Bob Carlyle because they'd been swayed by the allure and marketing pressure of a certain meat-based extract. Bovril certainly put their considerable resources behind their man. Dr. Dayton was preceded by a car emblazoned with Bovril. Adverts for the walk were taken out in national and local papers all along the way. He even started the football game between Middlesbrough and Blackburn Rovers as he passed by. There really wasn't much escaping Dr. Dayton. You might be a little bit surprised by the marketing heft of a hot beverage, but Bovril really was one of the biggest brands of the day, with advertising everywhere and a constant need to come up with new angles to keep the public interested. The other pertinent point here is that Bob carried out his 1879 walk all alone, but for his wheelbarrow. Dr. Dayton had all the latest technological trappings to hand and a full support team, a trainer and a car. Despite Dayton's cornering of the long-distance walking media, Carlyle continued his lonely plodding. Nevertheless, he was struggling. Struggling to make money and struggling to keep going. In fact, in August 1905, he gives an interview where he says that he thinks his walking days are near at an end. But he didn't give up, and he was still walking into the autumn and still working the press. This is an article from the Airdrie and Coatbridge Advertiser from Saturday, 9 September 1905.
The wheelbarrow craze has been not much heard of lately. But one of the trundlers turned up in Airdrie yesterday forenoon, accompanied by his wife. His name is Bob Carlyle. Bob, who is a quiet, healthy-looking man of about 50, says he is making a living by this means, taking what the people are pleased to subscribe for him en route. He was now on the road to Haddington, and a collection having been made among those who gathered round, Bob went on his way rejoicing, being joined further up the street by his better half.
I'll come back to the matter of his better half soon, but I have someone else to introduce first. It's hard to be sure, but as he went on his way, counting his coins from his collection, he might have passed very close to yet another end-to-end contender who was making very brisk progress in a northerly direction. This man had only started off from Land's End on Monday 29 August 1905, so he was on record-breaking form. His name was George H. Allen, and he was on a mission. Carlyle wasn't in his mind at all, though. It was Dr. Dayton who he had in his sights. Allen was expressly following Dayton's route, and he intended to beat his time. He had form. He'd walked 420 miles in 7 days, and in a failed attempt to cover 1,000 miles in 20 days in 1903, had managed a very respectable 455 miles in 9 days, despite terrible blisters on his feet. I'll let Allen himself explain why he chose to throw his hat into the ring.
Necessity, in the form of the record established by Dr. Dayton, forced me to again enter the lists. In the spring of 1904, this well-known athlete walked from Land's End to John O'Groats in 24 days and 4 hours. His chief sustenance en route was a much-advertised meat juice. The credit which had been given to the undoubted courage of Dr. Dayton was largely claimed by the company who ran the whole affair financially. To prove that flesh food generally, and meat juices in particular, are utterly unnecessary for such a feat of endurance, now seemed to be a task it was my duty to perform.
George Allen was a vegetarian, and Bovril, more than Dayton, was his adversary. He duly went on to smash Dayton's record by finishing in 17 days, assisted by a rotating band of friends on bicycles to keep him company, find the route for him, and organise food and lodgings on the way. So it's a bit of a rerun, in a way, of the tea versus beer dynamic of Bob Carlyle and E.P. Weston. Indeed, vegetarianism was linked to the temperance movement and followed its general approach to publicity. So that's not too surprising. Let's hear from temperance historian Dr. Anne-Marie McAllister about this.
Many people in the temperance movement also advocated vegetarianism or rational dress, for example, and believed in the benefits of deep breathing or various forms of exercise. So it's not at all surprising that a link arose.
To confuse matters, though, according to Bovril expert Leslie Steinitz, Bovril slotted into the temperance movement as a drink that was alcohol-free but not namby-pamby. It had a dark, macho look and a meaty, macho smell. You're probably wondering if there's any great secret to Alan's speedy progress. Well, he was certainly at odds with both the Bovril-quaffing Dr. Dayton and Bob Carlyle in eschewing meat. In terms of diet, Bob Carlyle was a meat-eater, but he was much more old-school than Dayton. He ate raw steak cut into small pieces, which he chewed to a white, papery pulp, which doesn't sound particularly appetising. Whether that was more or less nutritious than Bovril, I wouldn't like to say. Perhaps more important than diet was rest, though. Carlyle stated in 1906 that when attempting his long-distance walk, he avoided beds and full night sleep, preferring instead 3 hours on a hard bench, the harder the better, while still fully dressed in his walking clothes. George Allen took a much more sensible approach, to my mind. He had those cyclists riding ahead to secure him a good bed every night. Aside from those bicycling buddies, Allen also had age on his side. He was only 37 in 1905. But maybe the vegetarian pedestrian had taken advice from the latest expertise as well, in the form of a 1903 book by Charles Lang Neal entitled simply Walking. It includes the latest scientific research on the best way to walk, with copious illustrations to help. Allen would no doubt have taken issue with the section on best dietary choices, however, as C.L. Neal recommends meat in moderation, though he does suggest you go easy on the rich sauces and suet puddings. The back page of that book has been laid over to an advertiser, but Bovril had obviously already spent all their marketing budget on Dr. Dayton because it's OXO getting their message across there. OXO, it might be noted, sponsored the 1908 Olympic Marathon in London. I think we should pause for a second and consider concentrated meat extracts and athletic fueling techniques. Bovril and OXO are still household names today in the UK. If there's one thing that ultra runners and endurance athletes fixate on today, it's fueling and nutrition, and the likes of Dr. Dayton and George Allen were forerunners of this a century or so ago. Bob Carlyle was very much not. And one other thing, we can bring this whole web of science, diet and wheelbarrows all together when I tell you that in 1911, Jesse and Warren Buffum trundled a wheelbarrow from Boston to San Francisco and engaged in a scientific experiment. One of them ate vegetables and the other meat, and under the direction of a Harvard scientist, they weighed themselves periodically to prove which diet was superior for human mechanism. Sadly, I couldn't find the results of that scientific study, so I can't tell you the answer. It's also worth stopping for a moment to reflect on the fact that by this point we've moved into the age of both the bike and the car. Bicycles really became popular in the 1880s. In fact, in 1880, two men cycled from Land's End to John O'Groats, inspired, I'm sure, by Carlyle. Pneumatic tyres and the safety bicycle opened the sport up for the masses, and at one estimate there were 500,000 bikes on Britain's roads in the late 19th century. The Vegetarian Cycling Club was founded in 1888, and in 1891, G.P. Mills cycled from Land's End to John O'Groats in just 4 days, 11 hours and 17 minutes. Early motor cars were hitting the roads around the same time too, and certainly by the end of the century, people were driving the end-to-end route. Very curiously, in late March 1904, there are newspaper reports of a Mr. Douglas Whitehead attempting to break the record for driving from Land's End to John O'Groats and for doing it non-stop. He achieved the former, completing the distance in just under 43 hours, 6 hours faster than the previous best. But in the latter aim, he was thwarted by having to stop at several level crossings for trains to pass and wait for droves of sheep. He was also slowed by hitting a dog and several rabbits. Whitehead was the main driver, but he was relieved, according to the papers, by a certain R. Carlyle. Bob Carlyle, as we know, was at the same time in the middle of a John O'Groats to Land's End walk himself, but I guess it's not impossible that our indomitable subject was persuaded to take some time out to engage with more modern forms of transport. I wouldn't be surprised if it was Bob Carlyle in that car, but he certainly didn't have the resources or backers to purchase one himself. He was back walking soon enough, still pursuing the same formula of buttering up the papers to drag the maximum publicity value out of all his pedestrian efforts. His problem, though, that he wasn't making much money from the collection stops on his walks anymore. In fact, he told a reporter in 1903 that the game is hardly worth the candle. So again, he needed a bright idea. And for that bright idea, he turned back to his circus days and conjured up what he called an Indian peep show, even procuring a monkey for that added element of exoticism. Over to Bob Nicholson.
They're a kind of staple feature of Victorian street entertainment. You know, these travelling peep shows, which, you know, often sort of rolling into town, sometimes not necessarily that welcomed by the police or local authorities. But, you know, you would travel around, you know, set up your tent or your peep show. You know, people would sort of pay a little bit, a few pennies to maybe see it, and then you'd move on. It's kind of like a mini circus almost. I'd be interested to know what Carlyle showed in his, because, yeah, there's a whole range of things that would be shown in them. But sometimes it would be quite sort of gruesome stories about murder and all sorts of other bits of sensation, the kind of things that you sometimes wouldn't get printed in a more respectable newspaper. So there was sometimes, I think, perceived to be a slightly bad influence, shall we say, on the working classes by sort of respectable middle class observers.
The last few years of Carlyle's life were, I think, basically consumed by an endless walking loop, pushing the peep show and trying to make enough money to keep body and soul together. He was generally accompanied by his wife until she died in 1908. Carlyle, as we've seen, had very little to say about his wife and family in his own writings, but with a little bit of rustling in the records, we find out that his wife at this point was not the Mary who he married back in 1876. Spoiler alert, Bob Carlyle does eventually die, and on his death certificate, it's noted that he was a widower. So his wife is definitely dead at that point, but his wife isn't called Mary on that death certificate. She's called Janet Dalgleish. At some point, Carlyle's marriage to Mary had ended and he'd pitched up with Janet instead. I'm sad to say I don't know what's happened to Mary, Bob's first wife. Haven't been able to track her down. But if anyone can help, feel free to drop me a line. As we get to the end of the story, there's one last documentary reference that's worthy of mention. 1911 was the census year and it provides one last hint to Bob Carlyle's walking endeavours. He's logged as being in Redruth in Cornwall and he's on the very last of his Land's End to John O'Groats walks. He's recorded as being a 63-year-old showman, and he's staying in a lodging house. We know his wife was dead by then, and there are no other names that I recognise in that census, so I guess he was on his own. It feels kind of lonely, but there is one other little detail in that census report for the lodging house in Redruth. On the same night, there was a party of German musicians, the Forsch family, father, mother, sister, and teenage children from Bavaria. I just kind of hope that maybe Bob raised a stein or two with those travelling Germans to keep his spirits up on his lonely wanderings. He headed north, but his peep show had some serious mechanical failure and he had to leave it in Gateshead for repairs. I guess he never saw it again, but he made it to John O'Groats by September, which is pretty good going for a man of his age. By February of 1912, his days of walking were over. He died in Stewarton, Ayrshire, of apoplexy, and there are numerous obituaries in the papers. Perhaps the most poetic is this one in the North Star and Farmer's Chronicle.
Bob Carlyle, the famous pedestrian, has reached the end of life's rough road. A few days ago, he passed away at Stewarton. Bob, who was well known in Inverness, did the John O'Groats walk for the last time only a few months ago. In an interview then with the Highland Leader representative, he stated that he felt the end was drawing near. In the course of his wanderings up and down the country, wheeling his wheelbarrow, Carlyle covered little short of 30,000 miles and was familiar in many localities.
So that's it. What to make of a man like this? Why has he been forgotten?
I think when you read Carlyle's autobiography or any time when he's trying to tell his story, he does become really fixated on this idea that he's a reformed character, that he's been battling with, you know, the demon drink, as it would be called at the time, and that he's through religion, largely, he's saying, you know, he's found a way through it. And so certainly I think a lot of Victorians, I think, would have bought into that story of reform. The sense I get with Carlyle is that he never really fully finds his way out. You know, he has these moments of sobriety, these moments when he briefly finds religion. And that's, you know, that's a kind of story I think the Victorians would have enjoyed. But unfortunately for him, it's one that just keeps repeating.
That said, he was always interesting to people, always newsworthy. But perhaps his drinking was one of the reasons why he was never able to break through to real fame and why he isn't remembered today. He was certainly part of Victorian celebrity culture, but not an A-lister.
There was definitely a thriving culture of celebrity in the 19th century. And Carlyle was definitely trying to tap into this and to an extent at least seems to have made it through. You know, he was, as well as doing his pedestrianism, he was then being invited to give lectures in music halls. You know, he was being added to the bill for these things as a passing local celebrity. So he does seem to have managed to get a bit of a foothold in that, but not to the degree that he ever seems to have had a stable income from it. He was always just a kind of a fad that he was managing to rekindle over and over again, constantly trying his hand at something new, never able to sort of become one of those great musical stars who's been paid an obscene amount of money every week to appear in the same place at the top billing. He never quite gets that far, but he gives it a good go for sure.
There are paradoxes to the man. He seems at times both very Victorian and surprisingly modern, as Valerie Sanders explains.
He's a great self-publicist, but a lot of what he's doing, I was going to say anybody can do, not everybody can tow lines, but anybody can get hold of a barrow and start walking. And that sounds very modern to me. We're always trying to break records, and record breakers having a go at something ridiculous like, I don't know, walking dressed up as a giant balloon or making pancakes as you go and singing a song. You know, it's something that's just going to attract people to come out and look at you and put some money in your bucket. So I think he is a very modern figure, despite also being a very, very much a Victorian circus entertainer. I suppose it just shows that there is a continuity between the way people did things then without social media. If there'd been social media in his time, he'd have been on it and he'd have been posting constantly and had even more people out on the road. So word goes out that he's coming your way. And even if you don't want to give him any money, he's a phenomenon and it's worth turning out to see him pass through your street or your village.
Finally, he was just one of those people who can talk themselves in and out of trouble.
I think he really had the gift of the gab. He seems to have had a lot of confidence that he would land on his feet, whatever he did, to just throw himself into any situation. And as a result, he gets himself into an extraordinary range of different professions. And lion taming being perhaps the most surprising of them all.
Whatever you make of him, I think he provides a window into many worlds in the 19th and early 20th century. His was a life that was lived in the increasingly global world of steamship-borne commerce and travel, where technological change was hurtling forward. Yet it also provides us with a clear link back to the world of wooden ships and slavery that preceded it. With Carlisle's circus and pedestrian exploits, we can see into the increasingly important place of mass media in Victorian society, and the burgeoning spread of an entertainment and celebrity culture. His adventures with a wheelbarrow are, to my mind at least, just plain good fun, but they do also give us a sense of the development of the exercise and health movement, particularly among the middle classes, in the later 19th and early 20th century. That movement was, I guess, in part a reaction to the sort of problem drinking Carlisle and many others struggled with during the period. So we're reminded that many people sought release from hard lives through the bottle. Animal welfare, Anglo-American relations, family life, and the Victorian sense of humour are just some of the other threads that we've explored and that Carlisle's life brings into focus for us. So I reckon he's a fascinating man with a fascinating life, and someone who deserves to have his story told. I hope I've done him justice, and you've enjoyed the telling. That was episode 6 of History Extra's The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea. Don't forget, if you want to dive deeper into the topics that Bob Carlisle's life relates to, there are bonus episodes right now for History Extra members on the website, covering topics such as the temperance movement, pedestrianism, Victorian newspapers, 19th century life writing, and the world of the travelling circus. Go to historyextra.com/tiger-tamer-series to see what we've got. This is a History Extra production, researched, written, and hosted by me, David Musgrove. My colleagues Rhiannon Davis, Ellie Cawthorn, Eleanor Evans, and Rob Attar improved the script. Dr. Bob Nicholson kindly gave it a read through, and the producer was Jack Bateman. My experts in this series are Professor Valerie Sanders, Dr. Bob Nicholson, Dr. Anne-Marie McAllister, Dr. Martin Wilcox, Dr. John Wolfe, and Professor Dave Day. Thanks also to Sarah Williams, editor of Who Do You Think You Are magazine, for her help with untangling the genealogy. I'm also grateful to Chris Godfrey-Morell and Ken Bogle of Midlothian Council Library Service for helping to find the Black Collection in their archive. I owe thanks to Craig Statham, formerly of East Lothian Archives, and Hanita Ritchie in the John Gray Centre there, who helped me to track down some local records in East Lothian. Lisa D. Tommaso, librarian at the Murab Library in Penzance, and Linda Camage of the Penwith Local History Group were also generous with their time. The Museum of Cornish Life in Helston put me in touch with the wheelwright Terry Ansell, who helped me to understand more about Victorian wheelbarrows generally. Numerous other historians answered curious questions for me, including Dr. Richard Scully, Professor Nicholas Croson, Professor Rosalind Crone, and Dr. Vanessa Heggie. Finally, if you're interested in studying archive newspaper sources yourself, as a History Extra podcast listener, you can get a 10% discount on subscription to the British Newspaper Archive. Just go to britishnewspaperarchive.co.uk and use the code BNAHIST24 at checkout. And that offer is valid until 31 July 2024.